Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi. No, I'm David Gustina, not Alan Chartok. Alan is away this week, honored to be filling in, normally the producer of the show. And when these situations arise, I usually pick somebody that I know can hold his or her own throughout the program, so I won't have to say much. Enter Blair Horner, legislative director for the New York Public Interest Research Group, a man that is no stranger to the WAMC airwaves and certainly to our Capital Connection listeners, and who has spent a great deal of time looking at the legislature, and we're going to do more of that on the end of session today. Welcome, Blair Horner.
Well, thanks for having me, and I guess you were scraping through the bottom of the barrel when you found me. I guess that was what you were trying to do there.
You know, you're wrong, and you're not the pinch hitter, and you're the guy who can take...
No, I'm the water boy. I'm not even on the team.
No. You're the guy that can really do an analysis of the state legislature.
Well, let's go. What do you want to cover?
You know what? Let's start with something very simple. Uh-oh. Just in case there's someone out there that doesn't know. What is NYPIRG?
Oh, the trick question first. Yes. New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG, a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization that works on a wide variety of issues, primarily at the state capitol. We do some federal issue advocacy and some local issue advocacy, particularly in New York City. We have a board of directors that are all college and university students, so that sort of has the youthful flair to offset the curmudgeony old guy that you have on the show here today.
And not old.
That's right. That creaking sound the listeners are hearing is just my jaw. You know,
that's the chair. Cut it out.
But we work on a number of different issues, government reform issues, government accountability, environmental preservation, consumer protection, higher education issues, not surprisingly, and some social justice issues. So we have a broad range. We have lots of issues we work on, and we primarily do advocacy work at various state capitals.
And you're the head lobbyist. I mean, you are the lobbyist, but you're not a lobbyist in the traditional way.
No, I don't have a
people think about lobbyists.
I don't have a twirly mustache. I don't wear a bowler hat, and I don't slide envelopes of unmarked bills across the table. No, and under New York law, if you are getting paid $5,000 or more in a year, or you anticipate spending $5,000 or more to influence New York policy, you have to register with the state at an agency called the Joint Commission on Public Ethics. NYPIRG spends more than $5,000. I am their lobbyist, their primary lobbyist, and so I report my activities just like the other 6,700-plus registered lobbyists in New York State, representing roughly 4,200 clients, the people who pay them. So there's a lot of money at stake, $220 million involved in lobbying at this in New York, and we're one of the smaller fish in that particular pond, but we try to swim in it as best we can.
And I would say the biggest tool in your arsenal, right, would be the press, speaking out in the press about these issues you're concerned about.
We believe that the public supports our positions on issues, and so we do everything we can to get public attention on the issues we work on, because our view is if the public's paying attention, it helps. Just to give you some more numbers on this, In a two-year session, which is how long the sessions are, roughly 15,000 bills get introduced, roughly 1,000 of them pass the two houses, and maybe 100 of them get any real media attention. And so those issues get dealt with differently because the public's paying attention to them by lawmakers, and so it's a strategy on our part is to do what we can to get draw attention to our issues.
Well, let's draw some attention to the end of session. You've done quite an analysis of it, and we'll attack it from a number of fronts. Let's start with the idea that you point out there was a lot more activity in this legislative session. Didn't necessarily mean good things were happening.
Well, I mean, we'd like to do this sort of analysis of what happens in sessions in ways that people don't necessarily look at it, right? So we're sort of students of the game. And there's been a lot of talk, and accurate talk, that what really the session was about was kicking the can on major issues, that really big issues weren't really addressed. It's not to say bills didn't pass, of course, but that the big issues really, like on rent control, tax abatements for real estate developers, the property tax cap, regulation of schools and charter schools, by and large, those issues really were just extended. There weren't really any significant changes.
Something that's not unusual.
Well, not unusual, particularly in odd-numbered years. Odd-numbered years tend to be least productive of the two because lawmakers are not facing the voters.
Right.
So next year would be a year. So I just want to take a look at the numbers. And the one thing is you hear a lot about that this was not a particularly productive session. Compared to recent years, it was very productive. It was the most productive in terms of bills passing over the last 6 years. And now, while numbers don't tell the story of whether or not the bills that passed were actually any good, so, for example, one issue that was being hotly debated was what's the state's amphibian?
Well, sure.
The
wood frog.
The wood frog, the particular kind of frog.
Yeah.
And while most people would probably think that's not a big deal and probably doesn't matter in their lives, and they would be right, you know, numerically there was a lot done over the last 6 years. It was the year that was the most productive in terms of bills passing. But if you look at it, and we did, from 1920 through now, the historical trend has been downward, really, since the Rockefeller years, that the overall average trend, if you look at gubernatorial administrations, picks up from 1920, picks up a lot going into the 70s, and then starts to decline. And under the Cuomo administration, Cuomo II, we've seen the fewest number of bills passing on average in each of the years that he's been governor since 1920. So, you know, sort of interesting, you know, on the one hand, the historical trend is certain. So is this year a blip in that overall trend, or is it going to be the start of a new trend? It's hard to tell.
Try to answer your own question there. What do you think?
Well, I would think that the trend is the trend and this was a blip. I just think the way that the governor's powers have evolved over the past 100 years gives him much more leverage to get things done in the budget. And so the budget is a relatively small number of bills. And if the governor's jamming many of his policy initiatives in the budget bills, he doesn't have to try to get as many passed in the legislative process. Now, the legislature still does what it does. And there are more lawmakers than there were in 1920. And the sessions run longer than they did in 1920. So the budget sort of variable in this, while I think it's important, doesn't tell the whole story. I'm not exactly sure as to why the trend is the way it is, but my sense of it is there's no reason to think it would change. And I think this year, one of the reasons why some of the big issues weren't dealt with in any kind of comprehensive way was the tumult at the top, right? The arrests and indictments of the Speaker, the Speaker of the Assembly and then Senate Majority Leader.
And let's stay with that for a minute because, sure. Well, first of all, here's a question for you. In your entire career at NYPERG, have you ever seen a session like that?
Nope. And if I was around since 1920, I probably could say the same thing.
Right.
I mean, I don't think this has ever happened in the same session, both legislative leaders getting arrested, hauled off in handcuffs.
And a whole other coterie of people before and since being sentenced,
yes.
Like Malcolm Smith, all
yes.
Around that.
That's right. I mean, it really underscores how disconnected Albany's political elite has become from the normal mores of our culture. That they just assumed that they could do whatever they wanted and no one would ever check. And they were right until the U.S. Attorney's Office started paying attention to it and assigning FBI agents and investigators to Albany in the same way that they send investigators and FBI agents to, you know, monitor terrorists and the mob and Wall Street corruption. Albany now has shown up on the U.S. Attorney's radar screen, and he's deploying resources to do things. And I think if there's any hope for change, it comes from the word PREET.
Well, and you mentioned J-COPE, and that seems to, as Alan likes to say, have been called J-Joke, hasn't really done its job properly. So the U.S. attorney steps in. But long before that, when, as you said, Cuomo II ran for his first term, he came in saying he was going to clean up Albany. And then you have the Moreland Commission formed and then abruptly shut down. That seemed to get the ire of Preet Bharara, who then stepped in. So some of the analysis, as part of the end of session you've already alluded to, is these corruption scandals, what happened, and perhaps not as much negotiative power in the hands of the governor after some of these quote-unquote failures.
Well, I think the session, when you have new leaders in both houses, they get elected from conferences, and particularly in the Senate, where the Republican conference was split, there was a real fight over the leadership. And there were other combatants vying for the speakership after Sheldon Silver went down. When they become leaders, they're looking to solidify their base within the conference. And so they're on a short leash when it comes to negotiating. And I think one of the reasons why some of the major issues were not addressed the way they were was because the legislative leaders in both houses really, really, really have to look over their shoulder to make sure the conference is with them in a way that someone like Speaker Silver or even Senate Majority Leader Skelos, they had much longer leashes because of their longevity as leaders. The members of the conference were much more willing to trust in their judgment. They'd been down the road before, they knew how to negotiate, and therefore they were willing to cut them some slack. That's not the case here. So that made it harder. And the governor had new top staff, which probably didn't make it any easier either in terms of negotiating, because you didn't have the sort of level, the sort of the chemistry that might have existed in the first term of the Cuomo administration. So I think it was difficult in all those ways. And then at the heart of some of these issues at the end of session were the scandals indirectly, right? So in both cases, in Silver and Skelos' cases, prominent real estate developers played a major role. And one of them, Leonard Litwin, his top aide, flipped to be a state's evidence in the Skelos case.
Sure.
And Litwin looms large in the governor's sort of political circles. He donated a cool $1 million to the governor's reelection effort in 2014. And so I think everyone was a little more sensitive to doing something that would be viewed as overtly in the interest of the real estate industry. And so they just basically kicked the can and did some changes, but nothing, as far as I could tell, major.
But the thing sitting on the table is two leaders gone, corruption, no ethics reform.
It just shows, well, one of the things that you see with governors over time is their first terms they run as reformers. The second term they become the status quo. And it's hard to reform yourself.
But how much of this, Blair, is, well, let's take Joe Bruno, the former head of the Senate, who on the Honest Services statute ended up having that dismissed away.
Well, he was convicted.
Convicted, but then
on
appeal.
And then on appeal that the law, the underlying law was declared unconstitutional.
Right, too
general. And so he was then retried and acquitted.
But if you looked at what they essentially went after him on in the first place, that started a lot of knees shaking at the Capitol. So how many of these lawmakers in this final negotiation want to do anything on ethics reform anyway, since even the Speaker, Carl Hastie, who came in under a cloud of ethics?
Right, right. I mean, and the problem is, really, is the fact that no one is willing to create an independent watchdog, right? They don't want to have an institutionalized pre-Pararo running around Albany. And until you do that, all of these other things really don't mean a whole lot, because you can pass the best laws in the world, and if nobody's monitoring and enforcing them, it doesn't matter. And until they're willing to deal with that, or Barrara forces them to deal with it, they don't want to. And that's the problem. They came up in the budget. They did some ethics reforms. It was more, you know, rhetoric than real. And none of the good government groups blessed the deal. None of the, as far as I can remember anyway, none of the editorial pages. So when they did a fake ethics reform, they didn't even get the political cover that they were hoping for. All they got was a sort of weak talking point. And, you know, I mean, unless they're going to tackle the real issues, why should the public support what they're going to do? And they're not willing to tackle the real issues. Now, we got a whole year from now until the end of next session. If Barrara continues to bang away and these individuals, former speaker and the former Senate majority leader, they go to trial, more revelations occur, I think that's going to put really bone-crushing pressure on the governor and the legislature to do something going into an election year. Now, the governor can sort of kick the can because he's not up. But the legislature is going to be hard-pressed if this keeps going. Now, again, if Silver and Skelos are presumed innocent, right, and if they are declared innocent and there are no other investigations and arrests or indictments, maybe they'll dodge the bullet. And that might have been ultimately what they were hoping for. You stick your head in the sand, say nothing, draw no attention, put no more oxygen in the room on ethics reform, hope it goes away. And so the head-in-the-sand approach, whether or not that's a smart or dumb move, we'll know probably in a year.
Let's throw in Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, who came out not so long ago now and called for a full-time legislature.
Right.
How much, in your opinion, Blair Horner, legislative director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, our guest this week, how much would that take care of some of these other issues of using your part-time employment as a lawyer and your real estate dealings and all your other stuff that you end up making up your salary by making it on the side?
It would deal with a substantial portion of the potential conflicts and conflicts of interest that occur. If you're a lawmaker and you have a significant outside income from some other employment, you know, how do you separate those interests out? So the potential for a conflict exists. And there are rules in place now that you're supposed to follow, but nobody does. well, I shouldn't say nobody does, but nobody feels compelled to. They may do it on an honor system. They may choose not to. But it doesn't solve the entire problem because, again, someone has to enforce whatever those rules are. I mean, the governor, for example, is not allowed to have outside income, but he signed a book deal worth at least hundreds of thousands of dollars with HarperCollins, which is owned by Fox, which has business before the government, and he's making a ton of money off of that. So technically, right, technically he's not allowed to have outside income, but he's getting it, and because Jay Cope approved it, his appointee. And so, you know, you still have to have a real system. So, but just to sort of backtrack a little bit, the vast majority of lawmakers in both houses do not have substantial outside employment income. Most of them do not have it. Even lawyers that are in the legislature, many of which do not practice law on the side. They're just lawyers because they were. So for those people, it shouldn't make any difference at all, right? But it would make a difference for some of the high-profile cases that we've seen. The Bruno case was about outside income. The Skelos and Silver cases are about outside income. The Sampson case is about outside income. The Mel Miller case, the majority, the assembly speaker who was indicted prior to Sheldon Silver, was about outside employment. So it deals with a big problem. There's no doubt about it. But it doesn't deal with the only problem. So, for example, when Leonard Litwin is able to pump $1 million, a cool $1 million, into the governor's reelection effort in 2014, how was he able to do that? The laws say you're not supposed to be able to do that, but the laws are so riddled with loopholes that he was.
Well, let's go to that. I mean, you've talked about this dark money and the LLC stuff and the loopholes that are in the law. Talk about that.
Well, actually, the ironic thing is it's not in the law. It's an interpretation.
So
the listeners know the deal. Under the system of campaign finance in New York, limited liability companies, LLCs, are considered humans for the purposes of campaign contributions, and corporations are not. Corporations and businesses and trade associations are subject to a much lower campaign contribution limit than human beings.
And so each LLC is considered a different human.
That's right. And so if you're Leonard Litwin, for example, and I think he has 70 or 80 LLCs that he controls, each one of those are considered separate individuals, plus himself is considered a separate individual. And so you're able to bundle together lots of money. And while that allows people to circumvent the campaign contribution limit system, the second part of it is no one necessarily knows when 1, 2, 3 parking garage Manhattan is funneling, you know, $80,000 in campaign contributions. No one really knows who's in control of that without doing significant background research to sort of figure connect the dots. And so not only is it huge amounts of money coming into the system, it is often dark money in the sense that no one knows where it's coming from. And so even at the basic level of disclosure, which everybody likes to say, oh, we like disclosure. But then, you know, if they have to do something about it, it never happens. And as I mentioned before, there's nothing in the law that says anything about limited liability companies being subject to any campaign contribution limits. This is the interpretation of our State Board of Elections, which has refused to re-examine this issue despite repeated requests to do so.
And they always say, you know, we have to play by the rules as they currently exist, and until they change the rules, we're going to continue in this
fashion.
Yeah,
but it's their rules. I mean, it's the insane part. Like, their original justification after they did this was, well, the Federal Elections Commission is treating limited liability companies as human beings. Okay, then 2 years later, 2 to 3 years later, the Federal Elections Commission says, well, we got that one wrong. We consider now limited liability companies as businesses, but the state never went back. They just left it that way. And now they say, well, we can't change it because them's the rules. You need a law to change it. Well, why is that? They're the ones who made the crazy decision in the first place. It's just another example of how New Yorkers should demand independent watchdogs at all levels. Not ones controlled by the political parties. Like, who thought this was a great idea? The State Board of Elections, which runs the elections for the state, campaign finance, voter registration, elections, should be controlled by the two major political parties. Why is that a good deal? What about all the other people? Like, there's about, roughly a quarter of voters in New York are not enrolled in either one of the two political parties. They have no representation at the State Board of Elections.
Well, right.
That's bummer for them, right? Too bad, stinks to be you.
Unlike Massachusetts, where you could register as an independent, not an independence party, But as an independent.
I mean, here you can just say you're blank. That's
well,
what
right,
I am.
But you don't get to vote in the primary.
You don't get to vote in the primary. You don't get representation at the agency that runs the elections. Only the political parties do. That's insane. That's a terrible system. That's a system that just cries out for change. It should be run by civil servants. No accountability to anyone other than the public. They should be sworn to have a fiduciary responsibility to the public only, not the political parties, not the pals, not the hacks, but the 20 million New Yorkers who live here and pay the bills.
All right, you mentioned something in your rant there, which was,
sorry.
No, that's
I can't
fine.
Help myself. This, I forgot it's public radio, so I have to take
they
it
want,
easy.
We want to hear the rant. Listen, you mentioned voter registration. Do we have same-day voter registration?
We do not.
We do not.
The state of New York does not.
And there's always these ideas about a week of voting or a few days of voting.
Well, the state has a constitution. There's different levels of problems here. There's a constitutional issue. The state constitution creates the Board of Elections, for example, the way it is. The state constitution says you cannot register to vote within 10 days of an election. State law then says you can't register to vote within 25 days of an election. So you could fix the 25 to 10 relatively easily. But to change the state constitution is difficult. And so
accidentally on purpose?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, this goes a lot of this stuff goes back to like horse and buggy days, you know, okay. When like trying to figure out, you know, when people would vote in with writing on a piece of paper and sticking in a box with a slot on the top
sure.
of it or the old lever machines or whatever. I mean, it's a sort of horse and buggy system that doesn't really work in modern America. I mean, we're able now to withdraw money from our bank account while we're visiting or touring in Rome, Italy, with the same ease that we can pull money out of Rome, New York.
I can listen to WAMC on my smartphone.
There you go. There you go. And so we're able to transfer money that easily. We're able to get money easily, but we can't figure out a system that has a sort of quick way to register and vote or make it automatic.
Yeah.
You turn 18. Like, if you turn 18 in your mail, The Selective Service finds you and makes sure that you register
sure
for the Selective Service. Why don't we have things like that for voter registration? So why do we have this crazier system? It's got to change. One of the reasons why only 30% of New Yorkers voted in the 2014 election is because of the sort of the dumb and deliberate obstacles that exist in the system to make it hard to register, to vote, and to participate in the process. So all those systems have to change. There's some easy things you could do right away. The governor has called for the reduction in state law from 25 to 10. We'll see if he delivers on that promise coming into the next election cycle. There'll be a presidential primary in New York in April. All sorts of, you know, little games get played. Some of the older listeners may remember then-Governor Pataki derailed Forbes' effort to get on the ballot in 1996. And so the parties often have an interest to knock out in New York because it's so party dominant, knock out potential challengers. Be interesting to see what the governor does about Bernie Sanders. It'll be interesting to see what the Republicans are doing with their cast of thousands running for the nomination when the April vote rolls around. So there may be interest in addressing at least some reforms of the system because the presidential primaries really cast a strong light, on the practices of voting in each of the states, and I think it will show New York's to be sort of anachronistic.
Well, he is a bright light. His name is Blair Horner. He's a legislative director for the New York Public Interest Research Group. He's been our guest on the Capital Connection this week. I'm David Gustina, producer of the show, filling in for Alan Chartok. He'll return next week. In the meantime, Blair, just keep doing what you're doing and ranting and raving and telling those lawmakers off.
Thank you, David.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.